Group Meeting, Sunday, 13th May, 1984. We neither learn nor do things well under the stress of fear. We all know that fear is not something which heals, but it brings upon us a state of dis-ease. Now, rewards, on the other hand, tend to increase our greed, our self-esteem, and other aspects which leave us at a subhuman stage. With rewards, you get the element of competition. You also get the element of anxiety, whether you will get the prize or not, etc. So neither rewards nor punishments and fear and so forth are of any use at all. That is one of the reasons why, since the beginning of last autumn, we have paid attention to those elements which are included in all the religions of the world, which are related to fear on the one hand, fear and punishment on the one hand, and to the idea of rewards and self-exaggeration on the other. I'm referring, of course, as far as religion and the religious life is concerned, to these absurd doctrines of hell and heaven. The doctrines of hell and heaven involve the assumption of the continuity after death of a permanent identifiable entity. Now that I totally deny. The body is not merely a physical body. It is the appearance which enables us to recognize a particular person or other. The body is the complete embodiment of all the energies and forces which have played their part in the entire evolutionary process and finally brought forth man as one of its representations, one of their representations. Nothing survives death. Death is a transformation. A transformation of such a nature that we, constituted as we are, having the sort of perception and mental faculties that we have, we simply cannot see what that transformation is. But that transformation is of such a nature that all the forces that concretized into this manifestation called man are once more just those forces, those energies. So I utterly deny survival after death. How did this idea of survival come? I think it is due to dreams of the dead. The idea and the belief in survival is rather old. We need not measure it in thousands of years, or tens of thousands, or even scores of thousands of years. Go right back, as far back as you can, and see the hominid type separating from the pongid type in the evolutionary process from the primates. Now, the hominid type began to form little groups. First and foremost, of course, the family. And since the brain of man contains within itself the mammalian brain, which we derive from our mammalian ancestors, developed tens of millions of years ago, and their essential characteristic is the care for the young, protection for the young, and therefore an evolutionary process can go on. Now, because of that, the first hominids formed groups which were families. In course of time, remember this, time here means vast periods of time. In course of time, families got together, formed a tribe. Tribes were not always friendly with each other, partly due to the fact that one tribe may have had pleasant circumstances, was able to obtain food reasonably easily and so forth, and another tribe couldn't and felt jealous and wanted to snatch the other tribe's food and so on, and so war broke out. So Big Chief Sitting Bull, the strong man, slew his enemy. And some of the strong men of his tribe slew their enemies of the other tribe. And the same thing happened the other way around too. Not long afterwards, one fine night, Big Chief had a dream. He was absolutely certain he had slain his enemy, because he was buried and he could dig up the bones and prove the fact. He had a dream in which he saw the man whom he slew. And he must have experienced in that dream the sort of difficulties we experience when we have troublesome dreams. I know from my own experience, sometimes many, many years ago, I used to dream of seeing a lion. Now, I was so brave in the dream that I tried to run away as fast as I could. And I found my legs wouldn't carry me. And then I thought, now, can I get hold of something and ward off this lion? And my arms had lost all their youthful strength. I couldn't do a thing. So now, this Big Chief Sitting Bull also must have experienced something like that. You and I today understand the mechanism of dreams fairly well. But dear old Big Chief didn't understand it at all. What he saw in his dreams to him was practically the same as seeing the living creature materially on earth. So he woke up in a sweat of fear and terror. Now, I slew that man, my enemy. I see him in this dream. He doesn't know it's a dream. I saw him last night, and I couldn't do anything against him. Is he really dead, or is he still alive? In some mysterious form, which I cannot master anymore. And the others also who had similar dreams, they must have got together and thought about it and come to the conclusion that somehow or other, after the death of the body, one survives. The spirit, the idea of a spirit form, which was ordinarily entirely invisible, and which, when visible in dreams, was something which was sacrosanct. It couldn't be hurt. You couldn't ward it off. You couldn't do anything. So perhaps they started thinking, now it would be wise to make friends with these spirits. And of course the whole caboodle of placatory rites came into being, involving the senseless slaughter of animals and also of human beings and so forth. And this business of placatory rites is not only 3 or 4 million years old, it happens in our day too. In some form or other, the civilized peoples do it in their way, and the primitives do it in their way, but they do it, you see. So now, this idea of survival has been handed down like that from generation to generation. How many generations? Roughly 100,000 generations or so. And the idea of spirits. And just as the chief of the tribe was the ruler, in the spirit world they thought, of course, they must also have a ruler because we have one. Mankind has an inveterate habit of reading himself and how he functions and thinks and feels into the past, into that which is invisible, which is transcendent, and so on. So you can see the evolution of the idea of various gods and so forth, and godlings. Non-existent creatures, actually, but there they were, very real to those people. All nature was also invested with spirits, because nature displayed power which was immensely greater than anything that man had. Earthquakes, volcanoes, hurricanes, floods, and so forth. These absolutely destroyed everything. This was terrible power. And just as the big chief had power, and the strong man had power, so this must be the power of some invisible spirit, some god. I think it is that way that this whole idea of survival and the hosts of gods and godlings came about. Also, there were correspondingly the good gods, the favorable gods, and the favorable spirits and so forth. So the idea of angels and fairies and whatnot burst out. Man's imagination, his image-making faculty. That's his imagination. His image-making faculty produced all this and handed it over through thousands of generations till today too. The bulk of mankind believes in this particular type of recognition of that which transcends him. I am not for a moment denying the actuality, the absolute reality of transcendence, far from it. I have often used the phrases like this, the one total reality. I've used the word transcendence, you see. And the primordial creative energy. I prefer that to other terms merely because we live in a scientific age which has performed an extraordinary miracle in showing the interconvertibility of energy and matter. Energy by itself is invisible. It is intangible. You can't hand over a little bit of electricity to me on a plate and say, that's a bit of electricity for you. Can't be done. It's invisible, it's intangible, it's universal, it's total. Energy is energy. So, since we have had as our heritage, religious heritage, the idea of God as the supreme being who is a creator, he must also be represented by creative power. Creative power means creative energy. So God, if you like, is creative energy. Or put it the other way around, creative energy is the real meaning, or one real meaning, of the word God. So I do not deny that. There is an absolute something, but I do say that what that something is unknown, and it is unknowable by members of the human species as yet. Now, this idea of heaven and hell, punishment and reward. No, I just said around reward and punishment. I said heaven and hell, reward and punishment. It's no good holding a carrot or brandishing a sword at any human being in order to persuade him or compel him or teach him how so to live that he gradually flowers into perfect humanity, perfect humanness. And as I've said again and again before at our meetings, the word human means the happy or the blissful creator. We always have represented God as who lives in everlasting bliss and is the everlasting creator. So that is the real meaning of the word human. It is towards that we are evolving. And the particular change which takes place is the change in one's mode of awareness of existence, of reality. Our present mode is the mode of the finite and the temporal, and the mortal, therefore. The mode to which we are evolving consciously, in consciousness, is that of unitary wholeness. And the context of unitary wholeness is the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. That is the basic fact, the basic reality. That is as much as I can say, as far as I have seen for myself. Supposing I am right. In the next century, or perhaps a little later, somebody else will come along who has seen more deeply, and then what I say now will be less adequate statement. He will say something which will be more adequate and less misleading than my statement. That must always be understood. Otherwise, I who say these things would be awfully conceited. So now, it is, so now the question arises, how does the evolution of consciousness take place? How do we promote it? In one single word, by learning. But learning in this context does not mean the acquisition of knowledge. All knowledge and all activity of the brain, all our ordinary thinking and feeling and doing and so forth, is confined to the context of the finite and the temporal. It belongs to the context of mortality. Consciousness has to emerge out of this context of mortality and realize the state of unitary wholeness, in which state it is at home in the context of infinity, eternity, and immortality. That is man's, that is the purpose of this species on the globe. Or shall I say, one of the purposes at least. Now this learning can take place, as I said, not by the acquisition of knowledge. How does it take place then? This learning is the release of a dormant sensitivity in ourselves, which does not need to be burdened with knowledge. The release of this sensitivity takes place primarily through living the religious life, the good life. That's what it means. The religious life has nothing to do with doctrines, dogmas, beliefs, convictions, ideas, and all the rest of it. The religious life is the same as the fully human life. Human in the sense, I'm using the word human in the sense in which I've said is its real meaning, the happy creator. It is the same also as the everyday secular life lived in harmony with and expressing in actual manifestation all the great spiritual values. Wisdom, love, purity, goodness, truth, beauty. That is the real meaning of religious living. It's living the fully human life, which is the same as the everyday secular life, which expresses the great spiritual values. Now, when we live in that manner, or try to live in that manner, this dormant sensitivity in us begins to wake up. There will come the time when, if you are fortunate enough, I don't mean fortunate in the sense of pure chance or something like that, but fortunate in the sense in which the Buddha was called the fortunate one, Bhagava. You see, if you're fortunate enough, that flash of transcendence will light you up suddenly. And then you will know for certain. Now this time with the brain you will know for certain. Something which is the real meaning of infinity and of eternity. Where infinity is concerned, there is no here, there is no there, there is no distance, there is no separation, and at the same time, there is only everywhere, which is the absolute here. You see, it so completely negates all our knowledge and experience of the finitude of space and the finitude of existence. As an example, we say that something comes into being, proceeds, dies. Take as an example this standard lamp here. This is a piece of wood, isn't it? We say it's a piece of wood. We say this is matter. Now, we think of matter as ultimately perishing. Does it? Supposing we try to annihilate it, set fire to it, or find some means of, as we think, destroying it completely. Set fire to it is a simple example. Weigh this piece of wood before you set fire to it. Burn it. Weigh all the gases given off, the smoke, the ashes, and whatever other products are formed, and you will find that the two are identical in weight. All that has happened is that this piece of wood has changed form. It has undergone a transformation. But the matter that was here is still matter, unannihilated. It is immortal. You know, you can get it in a flash, maybe. Everything is absolutely immortal, but it doesn't stay put in a particular shape or form. That is the difference. Now, consciousness undergoes transformation, but that is nothing. Nothing has to be done to consciousness in order to change it. It changes by itself. It's inherent in consciousness itself. It functions through a creature called a man, say. You see? All right? That man, through as he grows up, through his experience and through whatsoever faculties are inherent in him, becomes aware of the world in this, that, or the other way. But that awareness of the world is a confined, finite awareness. He is not conscious of it in the full sense of the word. Take again this standard. If one is fully conscious of it, you will find that the brain has discarded all its descriptive terms. Wood, brown, carved, and all the other terms that you would use, weighs so much, this is its length, and all the rest of it. Those descriptive terms completely disappear when you're totally conscious of this thing. This is something of the nature of consciousness, which I don't know whether anybody has really sort of put it like that. So now, all these descriptive terms are the terms of a consciousness which is confined and limited. The possibility of its development and fruition is of course hidden in every one of us. In most human beings, throughout the 3 and 4 million years that we've been on the globe, it doesn't come to fruition. But that is the nature of things. That is the nature of the cosmos and growth and so on. Take a tree, for instance. A large oak tree, composed of countless millions of cells. Look at the changes it undergoes. The old is cast off in the autumn, in the spring, the new comes into being. All the cells continuously change. Now, the change in consciousness, in the case of us humans, is something which we can cooperate with the forces which bring about that change, which will enable consciousness in us to flower out into unitary wholeness. And then we will be aware of anything and everything in the universe in a totally different way. Not in the descriptive terms of the discursive mind. That is a fruition to which the human race is moving very, very slowly. Now, in order to move towards that fruition, which means the complete fruition and fulfillment of all our religiousness in us, which is embodied in us, hidden in us, you see, we have to be free to work with it. That freedom is wholly denied by doctrines of hell and heaven, because the doctrines involve fear and punishment, reward, and the expansion of the egoistic self, of the egoistic sense. The sense of separateness, of isolatedness. Our consciousness, as it functions at present, is isolative and separative. That isolativeness and separativeness is the root of all the troubles and sorrows that the human race goes through. I spoke about the tribes in conflict. Why in conflict? Because they were conscious in separative terms. He, the other fellow, has got food and the good things, I haven't. That's where the root of the whole thing is. Now, by living or trying to live in tune with the great spiritual values, this sense of separativeness disappears. Instead of thinking in terms of I and the other fellow, the sense of us grows. When this us consciousness grows, then we will have a truly harmonious society, a social group. But in order to have that social group, we must discard all these untenable beliefs. How many of you have read Dante's Divina Commedia? The Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso. I read it in my school days. 70 years back, practically. It's an appalling thing, except for the Paradiso. The Paradiso certainly presents the most aesthetic account of the pure and the deep states of consciousness as you grow. But the Inferno is just the result of the infernal doctrines that have been transmitted to us. And these doctrines which have been transmitted to us were started by Zarathustra, strangely enough, 1400 BC roughly. He propounded this idea of judgment after death and the consequent permanent through all time, heaven or hell. And then he propounded resurrection. You know, all these doctrines have been, you'll find in Judaism, in Christianity. You won't find them in Buddhism and Hinduism. But Buddhism and Hinduism fell into the trap of reincarnation, which involves the permanent entity. You can say, oh, it's character which comes back. That's all nonsense. If you look deeply enough into the mind of the person who believes in reincarnation, he sees it as a permanent entity, identifiable entity. But there's no such thing as a permanent identifiable entity, for the very simple reason that all manifestation comes into being, proceeds, and undergoes complete dissolution into something else. It's the something else-ness that defeats the idea of permanent identifiable entity. You know, people have never thought of these things. It's extraordinary how, through the thousands of years of great civilizations, East and West, somehow people have sort of shut their eyes to this. They've never challenged God. Challenge God, right, left, and center. Go for Him, and you will discover Him. Right here. And similarly, the devil, right here. Nowhere else. There's no other entity which is God. No other entity which is the devil. And once, look, the advantage of this is that once you can free yourself from clinging to all these ideas and beliefs, you'll free yourself from innumerable ideas, innumerable clogs which prevent your real progress. In freedom, the psyche, if you work upon the psyche in freedom, then living by the spiritual values becomes natural and easy. If it's not difficult, then you don't have to undergo a useless conflict inside the psyche. St. Paul, I think, in Hebrews, isn't it? The wages of sin is death. And what is sin? Whatsoever brings about conflict by virtue of trying to spoil or obstruct the unity of the universe. That is sin. Our isolative, separative consciousness is the root is the thing which gives meaning to the Catholic statement that man is born in sin. But the Catholics don't know this. I think they'd be very annoyed if they heard me say what the real meaning is. They don't know it. This sin, we are born that way. Why? Because this organism, which comes into the world as a conscious organism, is born inherits the ignorance of its parents and its ancestry. And it also inherits all the absurd beliefs that we have brought into being. So if we can really look into our own brains, I don't say mind, because mind is in itself is pure, universal, perfect, into our own psyche. But this universal energy which is called mind interacting with body gives rise to psyche, which is rooted in the brain and the nervous system, the ductus glands, the bloodstream, and so forth. Look into the psyche and keep looking, and you will see all these mistaken ideas and beliefs falling off like scabs. Then there is that inward freedom which leaves you full of an inward delight, an inward bubbling joy, which gives you the strength and the knowledge of how to go on with your daily life. See, that's why I have been rather concerned since last autumn that we who meet here should understand this sort of thing and see if they can make use of it. Make use of it. It will free you in the most extraordinary way and give you the strength to bear with difficulties. Not to oppose them. Never conflict with them. Look at the devil always and say, come along, let's have a cup of coffee together. And you'll very soon convert him into an angel. What is the devil? What is evil? What is vice? Our own psychophysical energy, our own electrochemical energy, expressing itself in painful ways, in difficult ways, absurd ways. That's what the devil is. And the angel is the opposite, expresses itself in harmonious ways. That's all. And since we are the possessors of this energy, by virtue of our existence, it is for us to utilize it and in the right way. Nobody else can tell you how you should do it. Everyone is unique. The primordial creative energy has manifests itself with the most extraordinary uniqueness throughout its multitudinous variety, and therefore each manifestation has to wake up to its own uniqueness and let that out. A rose cannot give you the perfume of a jasmine flower. Each has to be just what it is. And don't be afraid that what you think is, what you really believe in and have capacity to do, when you do it, don't be afraid whether it is right or wrong. Do it if you do it with your whole heart and soul. But don't include in that activities like terrorism. They also believe with their whole heart and soul that it is good. But since that heart and soul is completely diseased, the result is greater disease. and be happy whatever you do.